The following program contains language not entirely appropriate for general audiences. Listener discretion is advised. My name is Michael Welch, and you are listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. This week, we present a talk given by Cory Doctorow. Cory is a speaking on the subject of why every digital service we depend on is in a rapid decline, how it is not a coincidence, but due to choices by specific individuals, and what we can do to reverse this precipitous course by seizing the means of communication to make the internet a digital nervous system of a new connected world confronting environmental collapse, genocide, and rising fascism. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. So here on the Global Research News Hour is Cory Doctorow speaking on the subject of escaping the Anthropocene, why everything is terrible, and what we can do about it, recorded by myself at the event in Knox United Church in Winnipeg on May 2nd, 2024.
So we are living through, I would have it, the Anthropocene. It is a moment of great Anthropocene in which the services that matter to us, that we rely on, that are enmeshed in our lives, are all turning into giant piles of shit at once. And this is very frustrating. It's not just frustrating, it's demoralizing. And depending on how important these platforms are to you, who they connect you to, and how hard it would be to reestablish those connections, it can be really frightening to be living through this period. I think the Anthropocene framework that I developed goes a long way to explaining what's going on. It moves us out of a kind of mystical realm in which the great forces of history are conspiring to make the internet terrible, and into a material world in which specific individuals made specific decisions that made everything terrible. And these are decisions that we can reverse, and these are individuals whose names we can learn, whose home addresses we can research, and whose pitchfork sizes we can estimate. Anthropocene names the problem, and it also proposes a solution. It's not merely a way of saying things are getting worse, though it's fine with me if you want to use it loosely. But in case you want to use anthropocene in a precise and technical way, I'm going to break it down. And I'm going to break it down using a very contemporary metaphor, the metaphor of the pandemic. So let's talk about the symptoms of anthropocene. What does it look like if you are outside a firm that has become anthropocene? What are the symptoms it exhibits? And then I'm going to talk about the underlying mechanism, the thing that's happening inside the company that makes it exhibit those symptoms. Then I'm going to talk about its epidemiology. What is the contagion that's causing everything to get so shitty all at once? And then I'm going to propose some cures for reversing anthropocene, for disanthropifying things. So let's start with the symptoms, with what a doctor would call the natural history of anthropocene. So a company that contracts anthropocene goes through a very characteristic three-stage process of decay. So in the first stage, it is very good to its end users. Those end users pile in, they get locked in, and then it's worse to those end users and better to its business customers. Those business customers pile in and get locked in, and then it's worse to those business customers and those end users, and then it turns into a pile of shit. So let's do a case study. I always like to use Facebook as a case study for this. They're kind of the best example of this. When Facebook kicked off, it was only available to American college kids. You needed a .edu email address to sign up for Facebook. But in 2006, Facebook raised venture capital and opened up its doors to the world. And they made a simple pitch to those end users, to the general public. And the pitch was, yes, you are all using MySpace, and that's where all your friends are. But has it occurred to you that MySpace is owned by a crapulent, senescent, evil Australian billionaire named Rupert Murdoch, who spies on you with every hour that God sends? If you sign up for Facebook, we promise you that we will never spy on you, right? We are the surveillance-free alternative to MySpace. All you need to do is come to Facebook and tell us who matters to you in this world, right? Follow some people and tell us how you're connected to them. Articulate your social graph. And then whenever any of those people publish something that they want the people who follow them to see, we'll show it to you. So that was stage one. Facebook has this surplus, all that capital from its investors, and it's allocating it to these end users, right? It's giving them an experience where no one spies on them and they see the things they ask to see. And so those end users, they pile into Facebook and they lock themselves to Facebook. Now, Facebook, like most tech businesses, has something that economists call the network effect on its side. So network effects are when a firm or a product or a service gets better, the more people use it. So you joined Facebook because there were some people there you wanted to talk to. They made Facebook more valuable. And then other people came and joined to talk to you. You made Facebook more valuable too. Now, Facebook didn't just have these high network effects that drove its growth. It also had something that kept it from contracting again, which was high switching costs. Switching costs are another economist term, and they broadly mean everything you have to give up when you switch from one product or service to another. Now, in Facebook's case, the switching cost was losing contact with all the friends who followed you to Facebook and that you joined Facebook to hang out with. Now, in theory, you and all those friends could have collaborated to choose to go somewhere else on a certain day at a certain time. But in practice, you are hung by a third concept out of economics, which is the collective action problem. And you've all experienced the collective action problem. If you and like five friends in a group chat can't agree on what board game to play this Friday, you are experiencing the collective action problem. We've all been through versions of this. Now, it's hard enough when it's just you and a few friends, but when it's you and 200 people in your social graph on Facebook, and some of them are there because that's where their rare disease support group is. And some of them are there because they're part of a diasporic population. They left their home country, and that's how they stay in touch with people. And some of them are there because that's where their kid's Little League hockey game plans the carpool. And some of them are there because that's where their customers are. And some of them are there because that's where their comrades are. And getting all of these people to agree to leave Facebook, it's transcendentally hard. So Facebook's users engage in mutual hostage taking. And that is Facebook's cue to start withdrawing surplus from them and handing it over to these business customers, their publishers and their advertisers. So to the advertisers, Facebook turns around and says, hey, do you remember when we told these rubes that we weren't going to spy on them? Right? That was a total lie. And all you need to do is give us very small dollars and we will target ads to them with incredible precision. And not only that, because we're such good-natured slobs, we have an entire building full of engineers who do nothing every hour of the day but police ad fraud. So if you give us a dollar for an ad to be shown to a certain person, that person is going to see that ad. And then they went to the publishers and they said, hey, do you remember when we told these rubes we were only going to show them the things they asked to see? That was also a lie. All we ask of you is that you take some text from your perfectly cromulent website where you have a way of making money from users, you put a little excerpt, you add a link back to that website, and we're going to non-consensually cram it into the eyeballs of people who never asked to see it. You get a free traffic funnel, you monetize those users however you want. And so users stuck each other to Facebook, and then the publishers and advertisers got stuck to those users. And once everyone was stuck, it was the cue for Facebook to launch the third stage of enshittification. This is the clawing back of value from all of the stakeholders and the apportioning of that value to its shareholders. So for the users, that meant that Facebook dialed down the proportion of content in your feed that you asked to see to a kind of homeopathic dose. And then it filled the remaining void with things that people would pay to show you, content that publishers would pay to boost, ads that people would pay to reach you with, and so on. But for the advertisers, this wasn't a golden age. For the advertisers, prices went way up. Targeting fidelity went way down, and the amount of fraud went through the roof. So much so that when Procter & Gamble zeroed out its $100 million per year programmatic advertising spend, programmatic advertising is the industry's euphemism for surveillance advertising, they saw a $0 drop in sales from dropping that $100 million advertising spend, because those ads to a first approximation weren't being seen by anyone. It was just disappearing into a giant maw of ad fraud. So advertisers saw prices go up, fidelity go down, and ad fraud go through the roof. Publishers, meanwhile, found that they had to put longer and longer excerpts onto the website it, not just to reach their own subscribers, but also to have their material promoted as a recommendation to third parties. Eventually, they had to put so much of their articles on the website that it became a substitute for their own website, right? So there's no reason to click the link at the bottom. And then just to be sure, Facebook executed the coup de grace. They said, well, that link at the bottom of your website, at the bottom of your article, maybe it goes to your website, but maybe it goes to a malicious site. We're going to downrank anything that has a link off of Facebook. So just be a commodity backend supplier and monetize your content on Facebook using our rotten, fraudulent ad tech market, right? So what you end up with is these two groups now stuck to Facebook as well as their end users, and everyone's kind of pissed off and they're complaining about it, but Facebook's executives all got top marks at the Darth Vader MBA program, and so they learned that when people get angry at you for changing the deal, you just turn to them and you say, I have altered the arrangement. Pray I don't alter it further. This is when Facebook enters the most dangerous phase of enshittification. It has withdrawn all the available surplus. It has left just enough residue that it calculates as sufficient to keep everyone locked in. Everything else goes to the shareholders. The problem is that this is a very brittle equilibrium, right? The difference between I hate this place, but I can't stop coming back, and I hate this place and I'm never coming back, it's razor thin. It just takes one privacy scandal, one whistleblower, one live stream mass shooting, and people bolt for the exit. And when that happens, shareholders get cold feet, and they have these giant sell-offs. You might remember January 2022. That was a great moment in history. Facebook announced slightly more dismal than anticipated user numbers, and it triggered a $0.25 trillion mass sell-off of Facebook shares, the largest mass sell-off in corporate history. You love to see it. And so when things start to go south for these companies, and they're out of ideas and out of surpluses, well, then they do this thing that in Silicon Valley they call pivoting, but everywhere else in the world we call panicking. And in Facebook's case, it was Mark Zuckerberg sitting bolt upright in bed one night and saying, I've had a revelation. Look, I know I told you that the future would consist solely of you arguing with your racist uncle using a primitive text interface for the rest of time, but here's what's really going to happen. I'm going to convert you and everyone you love into a legless, sexless, low-polygon, heavily surveilled cartoon character in a virtual world called the Metaverse that I stole from a 25-year-old satirical cyberpunk novel, right? And that is the final stage of enshittification. That is when it turns into a pile of shit. So that is the procession of enshittification. That is what, if enshittification were a disease, we'd call its natural history. But that doesn't tell us how enshittification works. What's going on inside the firm as it enshittifies? Nor does it tell us, importantly, why is everything enshittifying right now? And without those ideas, we can't know what to do about enshittification. All right, so let's talk about the mechanism of enshittification. Why are digital companies so able to enshittify? Well, it's because they run on computers. I know that sounds very trite, but computers are incredibly flexible. Here's a little computer science jargon for you. Computers are universal Turing-complete von Neumann machines. That means that every computer can run every program that is valid. And this means that digital enterprises can alter the business logic on the back end from moment to moment and second to second on a per user basis, twiddling the knobs that adjust pricing, payouts, and all other elements of the way the business works from second to second in a way that makes it very easy to move value from one place to another. So think about how Uber prices driver labor. The scholar Vina Dubal has identified a phenomenon. She calls it algorithmic wage discrimination. And if you have two Uber drivers, one of whom is very selective about when they're willing to take a job, and the other one is very promiscuous, they actually have names for this within the Uber driver world. The drivers who are very selective call themselves pickers, and the ones who take every drive are call themselves ants. So if you're a picker, Uber offers you more per kilometer and per minute for the same drive as someone who's an ant. Right, so you get a higher wage that tempts you out of whatever other side hustle you have that's letting you pay the rent without taking every drive that comes your way from Uber. But if you start to take those drives, your wage starts to tighter down in small increments. And if you become more selective, your wage toggles back up again, up and down, playing you like a tireless fisherman who just has to wait out your attentiveness and vigilance until you find yourself settling in at a permanently lower wage with everything else that you were doing that allowed you to be more selective in your rides no longer a part of your life. Now, the kind of 19th century coal boss that Tennessee Ernie Ford wrote songs about, would have dearly loved to do this to coal miners and other kinds of heavy goods industry workers through all of time. It's not a hugely imaginative trip, but what it is one that's labor intensive. That black-hearted coal boss just couldn't build a boiler room big enough and fill it with enough guys in green eye shades to alter the wages for those coal miners fast enough to play this trick on them. So if you've ever seen anyone do the cup and balls or three-card Monty, there's a great video of Penn and Teller doing it in slow motion with clear cups so you can see how it's done. What you'll realize is that it's not a sophisticated trick. It's a simple trick done very quickly. And that's what they're doing with these digital services. They are moving the value around really quickly. And as with any shell game, the quickness of the hand is what deceives the eye. Think of those publishers that Facebook tempted into putting longer and longer excerpts onto its website. Those publishers, if they balked at publishing longer excerpts of their content on Facebook, Facebook's algorithm could notice that they were less enthusiastic about using Facebook, that cadence of their posting had slowed down, and it could pluck some random post out of their history and just give it 20 million views. And they'll be like, wait, Facebook is great for my business. I'll come back and put some more on it. This is also what TikTok does. So last year, a reporter at Forbes, Emily Baker White, had a wonderful article where she revealed the existence of something that TikTok calls its heating tool. Now, TikTok is very good at recommending stuff to us, sometimes eerily good at recommending stuff to us, but it doesn't just recommend things to us that we'll like. The people who run TikTok have the ability to turn a knob and take a random TikTok performer and shove them into the feeds of millions of people whom the algorithm does not predict will enjoy it. Now, they do this not to play fairy godmother, but to convince a creator that they should be creating for TikTok, to retool for TikTok. And they pile in, and they play Judas Goat. They go to their friends, and they say, hey, sports bros, I just got 30 million views on my sports bro content. TikTok is the best place to be a sports bro. And other sports bros pile in, and once they've got the base of sports bros who've made the commitment to tooling up to producing for TikTok's distinctive and characteristic form of content, then they can withdraw the heat from them, and they can find some astrologer and make her clean for the day and do it again, and bring in another community that they think would be valuable to them. So I call this the giant teddy bear gambit. If you've ever gone to a county fair, I grew up in Toronto with the CNE, by 10 in the morning, there'll be some guy walking around the midway with a giant teddy bear. And nominally, the way you win that giant teddy bear is by throwing five balls in a peach basket. But no one has ever managed to get five balls in the peach basket. The way that this guy got the giant teddy bear is the carny summoned him over, you know, around 9:30 in the morning and said, hey, fella, I like your face. Tell you what, you get one ball in this peach basket, I'm going to give you a keychain. If you get two keychains, I'll let you trade up to a giant teddy bear. And that guy's job is to walk around the midway all day convincing other people they can win a giant teddy bear, right? To punk their $5 down and fail to get five balls in the peach basket and walk away with a keychain. This is Joe Rogan and his $100 million from Spotify. So that's how the disease works. It is the ability to move value from one part of the business to another very quickly. Is the system of pumps that allows companies to enshittify, to apportion value, take it back, reapportion it, take it back, one iteration at a time until everyone gets tired out and finds themselves locked into the platform and then they can take the value for themselves. That's the method. All right, so what's the epidemiology? Why is everything enshittifying right now? What led to the enshittocene? What is it about this moment? So some people say it's the end of the zero interest rate policy. Some people say it's because the leaders at the tech giants changed over to a new generation. And some people say that it's Mercury in retrograde. I don't think it's any of these things. Well, for one thing, although free Fed money certainly did give these companies a lot more surplus to play with that they could allocate to different groups, Facebook was enshittifying years before the end of zero interest rate. As to whether or not it's these heroic founders departing and being replaced by these soulless bean counters who wreck the business, you know, sort of like Timothy Eaton's grandson running the empire into the ground, I don't think that's true either. I mean, when the Google boys came back to Google during their AI panic, which they call their AI pivot, Google got materially and instantaneously worse, as seemingly as a consequence of the return of its founders. And it absolutely cannot be Mercury in retrograde. I'm a Cancer, and as everyone knows, Cancers don't believe in astrology. Some more Cancers in the audience. There you go. So when a whole bunch of firms all change their conduct at the same time in the same way, I think that's a sign that the environment that they're operating in is changing. And I think that's what happened to tech. So tech companies, like all companies, want to make as much money as possible, but they have a conflicting imperative, which is that making as much money as possible requires spending some money on hiring workers and paying them. It requires that you put some money into your production processes to make goods of higher quality. And it requires that you let your end users, your customers, have some of that value. And the more value you allow your workers, your suppliers, and your customers to have, the less value you can return to your shareholders. So the equilibrium in which digital companies produce goods and services that we liked at a price that was fair under good working conditions for at least some of their workers, that was an equilibrium in which they thought charging more or making their quality worse or harming their workers would cost them more than they stood to gain by making things worse. So there are four forces that discipline all that discipline companies. Two of them are specific to tech companies, and two of them apply to every kind of company. So the first of those universal forces that discipline companies and make them afraid to make things worse is competition. On balance, a company that fears that you're going to take your business elsewhere treats you better in the anticipation that if they don't, they'll lose your business. And if they have the hubris to not heed the risks of competition, then they do lose your business and you do get to go elsewhere. The second force that disciplines all companies is regulation. When a company understands or believes that cheating will attract fines or penalties that exceed the value that they stand to make from cheating, on balance, they will cheat less, and if they do cheat, they will be punished by the regulators. So those are the two forces that afflict all companies and cause them to be more disciplined in how they treat us and how they treat their workers. There are two others that are specific to tech companies. The first one is self-help. So as I mentioned, computers are extremely flexible. They're universal Turing-complete von Neumann machines. They can run every program, and that means that they can run programs that disinshittify the things that their manufacturers have chosen to inshittify. A user can always avail themselves of a program that undoes the mischief of the maker of some tool or service that they're involved with. So imagine we're at a product planning meeting for a digital business and we're thinking about our website. And the person running the meeting says, folks, I've given it some thought, I've done some research, and I figured out that if we make our ads 20% more invasive, we can increase gross revenue from ads by 2%, and that's our key performance indicator, our KPI. We'll all get a big bonus. Everyone gets to take a ski holiday in France. So someone at that table who does not give a damn about user welfare will put their hand up and say, I like how you think, but has it occurred to you that if we make the ads 20% more obnoxious, 40% of our users might go to a search engine and type, how do I block ads? And if they do that, the expected revenue from those users, it's not status quo ante, 100% what we're getting from them now. It's not your projected 102% that gets us all a ski holiday in France. The revenue from those users is zero forever because no one ever went back to the search engine and typed, how do I start seeing ads again? And so every firm that is tempted to use technology to enact mischief upon us has to contend with the possibility that some technologists will undo their mischief and distribute the tools that allow all of us to avail ourselves of this demystifying, disinshittifying technology. Now, the final force that disciplines the tech sector is tech workers, who are a uniquely constituted workforce in recent history. So union density in tech is really low, but worker power in tech has historically been really high, and it hasn't been driven by solidarity, but by scarcity, right? There just weren't enough tech workers, and so their bosses were much more solicitous of their views because they knew that they could get a job somewhere else. Now, this led tech workers to have the opposite of class consciousness. They saw themselves instead as founders in waiting, entrepreneurs temporarily drawing a salary, heroic figures of a tech mission. And the tech bosses, they played into this. This is why you get mottos like Google's Don't Be Evil or Facebook's Make the World More Open and Connected. These were intended to and successful in instilling a sense of mission in their workers. The librarian theorist Fawzi Etar calls it vocational awe, but Elon Musk calls it being extremely hardcore. So you have these tech workers who have a lot of bargaining power, but they didn't flex it when their bosses demanded that they sacrifice their health, their family, their sleep, to meet their bosses' arbitrary deadlines. So long as those bosses transform their workplaces into whimsical campuses with gyms and gourmet cafeterias, laundry service, and even a service that would freeze your eggs so you could work through your fertile years, workers could tell themselves that they were being pampered and not being tricked into working like government mules. But for bosses, there is a downside to this tactic of motivating your workers with appeals to their sense of mission, namely that your workers will feel a sense of mission. So when you ask them to enshittify the products that they ruin their health to ship, they will experience a sense of profound moral injury. They will respond with outrage. I did not miss my mother's funeral to put more ads into Google Maps. And they will threaten to quit. Thus, tech workers formed a final bulwark against enshittification for many years, even as the other constraints eroded. The pre-enshittification era was not an era in which tech leaders were better or more beneficent. It was an era in which the tech leaders were more constrained, where their worst impulses were held in check by competition, by regulation, by the threat of self-help, and by their own workforces. So what happened? Well, one by one, each of those constraints was eroded, and then finally it disappeared, leaving the enshittificatory impulses of those bosses unchecked and ushering in the enshittocene that we're living in now. So it started with competition. From the Gilded Age until the Reagan years, in the United States, the purpose of competition law was widely understood as encouraging competition. However, starting in the neoliberal era, a new theory took hold, a theory that they called consumer welfare or consumer welfareism. And the basis of consumer welfare is that monopolies are intrinsically efficient and that when you find one in the wild, what you've discovered is someone who's doing a good job. So if everyone is buying all their things at the same store, and when they get there, they buy the same things, what you have found is the best store with the best products, and the last thing the government should do is step in and shut that store down. How counterproductive would it be to destroy the best store with the best products? And so as this theory took hold, governments all over the world stopped enforcing their competition laws. This theory was widely exported around the world, including to Europe, where the competition laws had been remade in the shape of American competition laws by American technocrats during the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. And so governments all over the world stopped enforcing their competition laws, their antitrust laws, and they sat idly by as companies violated those laws. So those companies were able to merge with their major competitors and absorb small companies before they could grow to become real big threats in an orgy of consolidation that produced the most inbred industries imaginable, whole sectors so incestuous they had the corporate equivalent of a Habsburg jaw. From eyeglasses to sea freight, from glass bottles to payment processing, from vitamin C to beer, nearly every important sector in our world is dominated by five or fewer large firms. Now, some smaller companies declined to sell out to these cartels, but again, the firms that made up these cartels were able to violate other competition laws with impunity, including the law against predatory pricing. So here's an example of that. Before Amazon became the single largest, most important e-commerce platform in the world, it was buying up e-commerce platforms that had conquered different verticals. And there was one that wouldn't sell. It was a company called Diapers.com. No points for guessing what they sold. And Amazon made an offer to Diapers.com, an offer literally they weren't supposed to refuse, but Diapers.com refused, and so Amazon tapped the capital markets, lit $100 million on fire over the ensuing months, selling diapers significantly below cost until Diapers.com went bankrupt, and then they bought Diapers.com for pennies on the dollar, and then they shut it down. And they didn't just get rid of Diapers.com, they taught every investor that if Amazon offers to buy your company, you better goddamn well sell it to them, which is how Amazon came to dominate the rest of the sector. And so competition has become a distant memory. The New Zealand software developer Tom Eastman says the web has become a collection of five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four.
You are listening to Cory Doctorow speaking to a large crowd in Knox United Church in Winnipeg on May 2nd, 2024, on the topic of escaping the enshittocene, why everything is terrible and what we can do about it. The show is on the Global Research News Hour on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg here is more of Mr. Doctorow.
Now, you may remember Lily Tomlin used to do this bit on Saturday Night Live where she'd pretend to be an AT&T operator doing ads for the Bell system. And they'd always end with her turning to the camera and saying, "We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company." Today's giants, they don't have to worry about competition. They don't care. They're Google. They're the search company, and they have 90% of the search market. So that's the first constraint gone. Competition slips away, and as it slips away, the second constraint, regulation, is also doomed. When an industry consists of hundreds of small and medium-sized firms, it is a mob. It's a rabble. Hundreds of companies can't agree on where to hold their annual industry meeting, much less what they're going to tell Parliament or their regulators when they go and lobby on the Hill. But when a sector dwindles to a bare handful of firms, it ceases to be a rabble, and it becomes a cartel. Five companies, or four, or three, or two, or just one company finds it easy to converge on a single set of talking points, and without the wasteful competition that would erode their profits, they have a lot of cash to spread around. Tech's regulatory capture allows it to flout the laws that otherwise constrain less concentrated sectors. Tech can pretend that violating our consumer, labor, or privacy rights is fine because they do it with an app. This is why competition matters. It's not just because competition makes companies work harder and share value with customers and workers. It's because competition keeps companies from being too big to fail and, most importantly, too big to jail. There's plenty of things that we don't want to improve through competition, and nevertheless, we want those companies involved in it to be weak. For example, commercial surveillance. It would be perverse to use competition to pit the commercial surveillance industry companies against one another to see who could become most efficient at violating our privacy rights. We don't want companies to perfect the art of violating our human rights. When companies harm us, we don't want them to compete to improve it. We want to extinguish the conduct altogether. But the more concentrated a sector is, the harder it is for regulators to hold it to account. Instead, the companies end up dominating their regulator, who come to ignore the harms that they inflict. So think about privacy here. Google and Facebook act as though they are immune to privacy law because they violate our privacy with an app. Just like Uber can violate labor law and say that it doesn't matter because it's doing it with an app. And Amazon can violate our consumer protection rights and say it doesn't matter because they do it with an app. Amazon has a $38 billion business that they call an advertising business. And I do the sarcastic finger quotes here because it's not an advertising business. It's payola for search placement. The top results when you search Amazon are not the best results for your search. They're the results from the companies willing to pay the most to be the top search result, which is why the first result on an Amazon search page is on average 29% more expensive than the best result for your search. And the first four results are on average 25% more expensive than the best result for your search. And on average, the best result for your search on Amazon is 17 places down on that search result page. Now, if you walked into Canadian Tire and you said, "Give me your cheapest packet of Duracell batteries," and they sold you a very expensive packet of batteries that weren't Duracell, the consumer regulator would go in and fine them and shut them down if they wouldn't stop doing it. But Amazon gets to do it and say, "It doesn't matter, we did it with an app." This is where that third constraint, self-help, would sure come in handy. If you don't want your privacy violated, you don't have to wait for the regulator to wake up and do something about privacy. You can just install an ad blocker. More than half of the web has installed an ad blocker. More than half of the world web users have installed an ad blocker. It is the most successful consumer boycott in human history. But the web is an open platform. It dates from that period in which the internet was being built by a rabble, hundreds of small companies that couldn't agree on anything and no one could capture the web. Today, though, the web is being devoured by apps, and apps are purpose-built for enshittification. Because regulatory capture, it's not just the ability to flout regulation, it's also the ability to wield regulation against your adversaries. So today's tech giants, they got big by using those same self-help measures that we talked about earlier. When Facebook was telling MySpace users that they should abandon Facebook and the evil Australian billionaire, or MySpace and the evil Australian billionaire, their pitch didn't end there, right? They didn't say, "Come to Facebook where we have a better privacy policy and just reread the privacy policy until your friends get the message and leave MySpace and join me here." Instead, Facebook gave those MySpace refugees a bot, and you gave the bot your login and your password for MySpace, and it would go to MySpace several times a day, scrape all the messages waiting in your inbox, bring them back to Facebook, put them in your Facebook inbox, and you could reply to them and it would push them back out again. You didn't have to choose between the people you left behind and the service that gave you a better deal. The switching costs were zero, or the cost of just setting up this bot. But if you were to do that to Facebook today, they would say that you violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that you were tortious interferer with their contracts and so on. They would ruin you. And when Microsoft was choking off Apple's market oxygen by refusing to ship a functional version of Microsoft Office for the Mac, and people were throwing away the Macs in their offices and replacing them with PCs, even for their graphic designers, and just putting a big graphics card in and buying some software from Adobe, Steve Jobs did not resolve this by going on bent knee to Bill Gates and begging him to fix Microsoft Office for the Mac. Instead, some of his technologists reverse-engineered Microsoft Office and made the iWork suite, Pages, Numbers, and Keynote, which reads and writes all the files from Microsoft Office, Excel, PowerPoint, and Word. If you did that to Apple today, right? If you were to make a runtime that could run Android Apple apps on an Android device or a Windows machine or a Linux machine, or it just play back those files that you bought from Apple's media stores, they would nuke you until you glowed. Right? And Google, when Google started, they went and they scraped the web. They knocked on the door of every web server and said, "Hi, I'm just a web user. Do you have any web pages? Oh, those ones were really good. I found these links to other web pages. Can I have those too? Oh, those were good too. Can I have the next ones?" Do that to Google, scrape Google, the bomb hits other bubble bounces. So the regulatory capture that tech has engaged in doesn't end at just ignoring the law. It allows them to mobilize the law against competition. And it's mind-boggling how far this goes. So take that law I mentioned in passing earlier, Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA. This is a law that was signed into law in 1998 by Bill Clinton, and it constitutes a blanket prohibition on removing encryption that's used to restrict access to a copyrighted work, so breaking open copy protection. And it's prohibited without any regard to whether anyone violates copyright. It doesn't matter whether you violate copyright, just removing the protection is itself a crime. And it's a very serious crime. In the United States, it carries a minimum a sentence of a 5-year prison sentence and $500,000 fine for a first offense. So this law has been so expanded by the tech sector that it can actually be used, a copyright law can be used to punish creators of copyrighted works who give access to people who bought those works to the works themselves. And here's how that works. Back in 2008, Amazon bought a company called Audible. Audible was then the leading audiobook supplier in the world. Today, they're a monopoly, 90% of the audiobook market. That is a merger that never would have been prohibited under traditional antitrust law, but it was in the period of antitrust law forbearance when we let companies break the law. So Audible, now the 90% market share monopolist, requires that everyone who sells an audiobook on its platform has to allow it to put its encryption around the audiobook. Encryption that cannot be removed under penalty of law by anyone except Audible, and which requires you to use an Audible authorized player to play back that book. So say I write a book, which is a thing I do with dismal regularity, right? And then I read it into a microphone, which I do every now and again, and then I pay an engineer and a director thousands of dollars to turn that into an audiobook, and then I sell it to you for $17 on Audible. If I later decide that I want to leave Audible, like last year when Audible got into the scandal, the Audiblegate scandal, where they were caught stealing $100 million from independent audiobook authors. If I want to leave Audible and I want to take you with me, right, because there's no point in leaving if my listeners can't come with me, I can't provide you with a tool to remove Audible's encryption from the audiobook I sold you and let you take it with you to another platform where I'm going to get a better deal, which means that I remain stuck to Audible, which means Audible can continue to abuse me all they want. Now, the penalty for providing you with that tool is a $500,000 fine and a 5-year prison sentence. So that is significantly higher than the penalty you would face if you were to just go to a torrent site and download an infringing copy of my audiobook. It's also a significantly worse penalty than you would face if you were to go into a truck stop and find a copy of it on CD and shoplift it. It's probably a harsher penalty than you would face if you hijacked the truck that delivered the CDs to the truck stop. So think of those ad blockers again. We're back in our product planning meeting. We've decided we're not going to enshittify the website. But the guy who's running the meeting, he says, well, I also figured that if we made the ads on the app 20% more obnoxious, we could get that 2% lift. And he looks expectantly at the guy who said before, but what about if people search for how do I block ads? And that guy says, I got an idea. Why don't we make the ads 100% more obnoxious and get a 10% increase in our ad revenue? Because if anyone goes to the search engine and types, how do I block ads in the app? The answer they're going to get is you can't. Because reverse engineering the app involves removing the copy protection, the encryption from it, and that is a crime. And so while more than 50% of our web users have installed an ad blocker for the web, no one's got an ad blocker for an app. This is why every company wants you to use their apps instead of their websites, right? An app is just a web page skinned in enough IP to make it a felony to defend your privacy while you use it. This is something that Jay Freeman, the developer of a third-party app store for iOS, he calls it felony contempt of business model. So this may sound like an American problem, and certainly it's a problem that started in America, but I'm here to tell you, quite sadly, that if all of the American Congress jumps off the CN Tower, Parliament will line up to do it next. So 14 years after America passed this dreadful law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, in 2012, the disgraced sex pest Tony Clement and his Renfield James Moore of Coquitlam passed a nearly identical law here, Bill C-11. Now, Moore and Clement, they consulted on whether to include this anti-circumvention clause in their bill, and they got 6,192 submissions, of which 6,138 opposed the inclusion of this clause. 54 of the submissions supported it, and they passed it anyway. And the way that they justified it is James Moore went on record saying that all those objections came from radical extremists. And so today in Canada, we are living with the legacy of these sellouts and the incredible power of the U.S. Trade Representative to find sellouts in governments around the world and get them to pass these rules. Self-help is a really powerful tool. There's no reason that gig workers who are facing algorithmic wage discrimination couldn't all get together and run apps that automatically refused any job that dropped below a certain threshold. No reason except felony contempt of business model, the threat that any toolsmith who builds this for a group of workers would face punitive legal challenges that could lead to them going broke or landing in prison for violating DMC 1201, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, trademark, copyright, patent, contract, trade secrecy, non-disclosure, and non-compete. Right? All of those IP rights that basically constitute the right for a company to reach beyond its four walls and control the conduct of its critics, its competitors, and its own customers. So what about that fourth constraint? What happened to our tech workers? Well, for decades, tech workers' high bargaining power and vocational law, they put a ceiling on enchidification. Even after the tech sector shrank to a handful of giants, even after they captured their regulators so that they could violate our consumer, our privacy, and our labor rights, even after they created this felony contempt of business model regime and extinguished the self-help that tech users could avail themselves of, they were constrained by their workers' sense of moral injury in the face of the imperative to enchidify the products that they'd worked so hard on. Remember when tech workers dreamt of working for a big company for a few years before striking out on their own to start their own company that knocked over that tech giant? And then that dream shrank, and it was work for a big dumb tech giant for a few years, and then go out and start a fake startup in the hopes of having an acqui-hire where your old boss buys your company and gives you a raise and a bonus, right? It's the least efficient way to rise up the org chart. And then that dream shrank further. Okay, I'm not going to do that, but at least I'll have a job for life with this big dumb tech company, and they give me free kombucha in the cafeteria, and I get a massage every Wednesday. Well, last year, they fired 260,000 tech workers. Google fired 12,000 workers just months after an $80 billion stock buyback that would have paid their wages for the next 27 years. Tech workers today are not lining up to say, I refuse to enchidify this, and if you make me, I'll quit, because their bosses say, fine, quit. Oh, yeah, and that smart badge we make you wear, make sure you turn it in. Those are expensive. In other words, the same executives with the same impulses tried the same tactics to extract value from their platforms, making things worse for business customers and end users, but without the constraints of competition, regulation, self-help, and their workforce. Every day they go to work and they yank on the enchidify lever. For most of history, it was stuck. And this time it went all the way to 100. So I get that this is a little depressing. Maybe it's a lot depressing. But hear me out. We have identified the disease. We've traced its natural history. We've learned how to spot its symptoms. The locking in of users and then business customers and the transfer of value from both to the platform. We've identified the underlying mechanism, the system of digital flexibility that acts as a pump to move value around so that the shell game can be played with super fast hands. We unraveled its epidemiology, the collapse of the constraints that once prevented incentivization from taking root most of the time. And when it did take root, when a company did go bad, the company failed rather than shambling along like a zombie. Now we understand the disease, we can get to work on a cure. Now there are four forces that constrain companies and prevent incentivization: competition, regulation, self-help, and their workforce. To reverse incentivization and guard against its reemergence, we need to restore and strengthen each of those. And on competition, it's actually looking pretty good. In the United States, the UK, in the European Union, Australia, Japan, South Korea, even in China, we are doing more on competition than we've seen in generations. They are blocking mergers. They're unwinding existing mergers, suing to break up the largest tech companies, taking action on predatory pricing and other sleazy tactics. They have the laws to do it, right? They just haven't enforced them. Now, the incentivizers are not taking this lying down. The business press cannot stop talking about how stupid and old-fashioned all of this is. They call people like me hipster antitrust. And they really hate the regulators who stepped up to do their jobs. Like, there's this woman, Lena Khan, the youngest chair of the Federal Trade Commission ever. And she's done more in her career of 3.5 years than all of her predecessors for the last 40 years. But Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal has run more than 100 editorials complaining that she is a do-nothing time waster who can't get anything done. Rupert Murdoch does not pay his editorial board to write 100 editorials about someone who's not doing anything. Even Canada is stepping up on competition. Canada, the land of the evil billionaire, from Ted Rogers to Galen Weston, who did the most Les Mis ass antitrust violation when he conspired to hike the price of bread. Galen, do you want guillotines? This is how you get guillotines. Even Canada is doing something about this. Last autumn, Trudeau's budget speech included a promise to finally include an abuse of dominance standard in our competition law. Now, having a competition law with an abuse of dominance standard is like having a criminal code without a murder law in it. But nevertheless, you know, finally we're catching up with the rest of the world and getting one of these. Competition has a long way to go, absolutely. But all over the world, competition is in the midst of a massive revitalization. It's true, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher put it into a coma 40 years ago, but it's woken up, it's got its boots on, and it is pissed. So what about regulation? How do we get those tech companies to stop doing the one weird trick of adding with an app to the crimes that they do and escaping enforcement? Well, in Europe, they're starting to figure it out. The Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act went into effect a couple of months ago. They're a mixed bag. There's some stuff in it that I think is amazing, stuff that I think is terrible. But here's a really interesting component that I think has not been discussed nearly enough, which is the enforcement mechanism. With the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act, enforcement starts at the federal European court, not in the national courts where the companies are headquartered. And that's important because all the tech companies pretend that they're based in Ireland, which is a tax haven, which became a crime haven. All tax havens become crime havens because any company that is nimble enough to pretend to be Irish could pretend to be Luxembourgian or Cypriot or Dutch or Maltese next year. And so if Ireland wants to keep these companies happy, it has to not enforce its privacy laws, which is why the German competition regulator is hearing about 500 cases, major cases every year. And the Irish competition regulator, who is overseeing the largest tech companies in the continent, is hearing about 17 major cases per year and then getting overturned on most of them when they reach the federal court. And so we are now seeing these rules being moved into a federal jurisdiction where it's going to be harder for tech companies in Europe to capture the regulation process. And in the U.S., this is amazing, they are finally contemplating passing a new consumer privacy law. I can't tell you how backwards the United States is on consumer privacy. The last consumer privacy law America got was in 1988. It's called the Video Privacy Protection Act, or VPPA, and it bans video store clerks from telling the newspapers what VHS cassettes you took home. That's the last time Congress took up the question of consumer privacy. It's been a minute. So the thing is, there are a lot of people who are angry about stuff that has some nexus with this dreadful state of privacy law in the United States. People who disagree with each other about everything, including the stuff they're angry about, but agree that a privacy law would help them. You know, are you worried that Facebook made Grampy into a QAnon? Are you worried that Insta made your teenager an anorexic? Is TikTok brainwashing the millennials in your life into quoting Osama bin Laden? Are you worried that, like, the cops are rolling up the identities of everyone who shows up at a George Floyd protest by asking Google for their location data? Or that they did the same thing to the January 6th insurrectionists? Are you worried that black people are being discriminated against when they apply for a job or a loan? Are you worried that red state attorneys general are following teenagers out of state and into abortion clinics across the state line? Are you worried that someone's making an AI deepfake porn of you? No matter what it is you're worried about, it has some nexus with privacy. And the one thing that we know about politics is that big coalitions get things done. And the coalition that is coalescing around privacy as the necessary, if insufficient, precondition for solving all of these problems is actually making an enormous push, both in regulatory and in legislative circles in the United States. And I think we are on the verge of getting a really significant, muscular new privacy law in the United States. So what about self-help? Well, self-help's a little farther away, alas. In Europe, the Digital Markets Act is going to force the companies to offer gateways so you can plug new services into them. But if that gateway doesn't suit your needs and you want to use guerrilla tactics like scraping or reverse engineering, the DMA doesn't have anything for you. I think it would be fairly on brand for Europe to take the path of prescribing how tech companies must comport themselves, and for America to just say, all right, we're just going to withdraw the legal protection that allows tech companies to stop other companies or tinkerers or co-ops or individuals from trying to change how they work with the service, a kind of YOLO approach. And I think that those two approaches would be really complementary in that, if we want to know whether or not the European approach that's ordering companies to stand up a gateway is actually delivering what companies need or what new interoperators need, people need for their self-help, just look and see whether they are going to the United States and reverse engineering their own less stable, more difficult to create interoperable gateway because the mandated one isn't doing it. And if so, then we know that the European rule isn't doing what it's supposed to do. So these are really complementary approaches. And we are seeing some green shoots for it in the United States, and that's through right to repair legislation. In Oregon, they just passed the best right to repair legislation the United States has seen to date, and it specifically bans something called parts pairing, which is using that same encryption technology that locks up Amazon audiobooks and locks up apps and so on. It uses it to lock up parts in electronic devices and cars and tractors, so that you take a part, an actual manufacturer's OEM part, and you put it in the engine of your car, and the car's computer goes to the part and says, were you installed by a licensed technician? And if it doesn't get the right answer, the code that the licensed technician types in when they install it, then the engine refuses to see or use the part. Oregon's just banned that. They just said, if you do that, you can't sell goods in Oregon. And Oregon's a relatively populous state, and they've got some real muscle, and now that is becoming the goal around the country. And I think that this technology that reaches out after the purchase and prescribes how you use a product or service and requires you to arrange your fares to the benefit of the shareholders, this is something that we all intuitively rail against, that we all feel is too much. You know, Stein's law says anything that can't go on forever eventually stops. And these companies are getting so greedy. You know, HP has a whole building full of engineers that do nothing but try to think ways of tormenting you with your printer and forcing you to spend $10,000 a gallon on ink to print out your boarding cards and shopping lists and your kids' homework. It's offensive. And the constituency in favor of it is just the most greedy sociopathic people in our land, people who dream of using this technology in other kinds of digital devices, you know, like Medtronic, the medtech monopolist, who wants to use this with medical implants to force people who have insulin pumps and continuous glucose monitors to use just their brand and maybe someday to just use their brand of insulin too, to become a kind of walking inkjet printer. So that's self-help. Now, what about labor? Well, there is a massive surge in tech unionization. Admittedly, it's growing from a very small base, but it's growing fast, because tech workers have realized that they are not founders in waiting. The days of free massages, facial piercings, and going to work wearing black t-shirts that say things your boss doesn't understand, they're coming to an end. In Seattle, Amazon's coders walked out with their warehouse workers because they understood that they were workers too. The only reason those tech workers aren't being monitored by the same AIs that monitor those warehouse workers and being docked every time they go to the bathroom so they have to keep a jar next to their computer to piss in is because they have bargaining power that's rapidly going away. And you know, for a guy who builds penis-shaped rockets, Jeff Bezos really hates his workers' kidneys. So we are seeing bold, muscular action on competition and regulation and labor, with self-help bringing up the rear. And it's not a moment too soon, because the bad news is that enchidification is coming for every industry. Once you put a network computer inside it, the people who run the Darth Vader NBA playbook can use it on that device. They can change the rules from moment to moment, violate your rights, and say, it's okay, we did it with an app. From Mercedes wanting to rent you the accelerator pedal in your car by the month, to companies that make Internet of Things dishwashers that want you to use their special expensive soap, enchidification is metastasizing into every corner of our lives. Software is not something that eats the world, it's something that enchidifies the world. We've been paying attention to the wrong end of the elementary canal. But there is a bright side to this. If everyone is threatened by enchidification, then everyone has a stake in disenchidification. Just as with that privacy law coalition forming in the United States, the potential anti-enchidification coalition is so large as to be unstoppable. Now, some of you here tonight may be feeling a little cynical, a little skeptical that any of this is going to make a difference, that enchidification is just a synonym for capitalism. I don't think it is. Like, I'm not going to cape for capitalism here. I am not a true believer in the power of markets to be efficient allocators of all of our resources and arbiters of our policy. If there was ever any belief that that could be true, surely it was banished by the burgeoning climate emergency. But the capitalism of 20 years was different. It made a space for a wild and woolly internet, a space where people with disfavored views could find each other, offer mutual aid, and work in solidarity to organize. And the capitalism of today transformed that internet into a global digital ghost mall filled with bot shit, crap gadgets that come from brands whose names are all consonants, and cryptocurrency scams. Now, the internet is not more important than the climate emergency. It's not more important than gender justice. It's not more important than racial justice or inequality. And it's certainly not more important than genocide. But the internet is the terrain on which we are going to fight all of those fights. Without the free, fair, and open internet, we lose those fights before they're joined. We can reverse the enchidification of the internet. We can halt the creeping enchidification of every digital device. We can build a better enchidification-resistant digital nervous system fit to coordinate the mass movements that we will need to fight fascism and genocide and save our planet and species. There is nothing about revolutionary struggle that is improved by your comrades living in a worse life that's harder. Martin Luther King once said, "It's true, the law can't make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me, and that's important." And it's true, the law can't force our corporate sociopaths to conceive of you as a human being entitled to dignity and fair treatment, and not just as an ambulatory wallet or a food source for the immortal colony organism we call a limited liability corporation. But it can make that executive treat you fairly and afford you dignity, even though he manifestly does not think you deserve it. And I think that's pretty important.
You just heard the talk, Escaping the Enchidocene, Why Everything is Terrible and What We Can Do About It, by speaker Cory Doctorow at Knox United Church in Winnipeg on May 2, 2024. This talk was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Manitoba Chapter and CKUW 95.9 FM. The show, Global Research NewsHour, is funded by the Centre for Research on Globalization, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Music was Shifting Sands from the Purple Planet Music, available at purple-planet.com. The show is also broadcast on multiple stations across Canada and the United States. My name is Michael Welch. Listen to another special summer show next week.